Good afternoon, everyone. Let us see what the questions are. I just found them in this golden box. I've heard that meditation on the impermanence of the body and death is an important topic. How should one approach this or any other topic? It seems to require more mental chatter than mindfulness or tranquility meditation. Right. Of course, the or any other topic opens up to a lot of things, but let's see the first part. First, the meditation on the impermanence of the body and death is an important topic. Yeah, there are different ways of meditating on the impermanence. Now, for instance, our mindfulness itself shows the impermanence of the body already. There are other meditations which are called contemplation on the impermanence of the body and contemplation on death, which have more cerebral activity, like thinking about that topic, or even in the time of the Buddha, you know, there were no crematoria like nowadays. The bodies were sometimes put in a what is called a charnel ground and then left there to the vultures and other kind of animals. And one of the contemplations that the Buddhist monks in those days did is go to the charnel ground and look at those bodies and see them for a number of days going into different states of decomposition. That would be a contemplation on the impermanence of the body for themselves by actually seeing a body of a dead person who passed away and was left there. Nowadays, one doesn't really have such a chance, if you like. One could also, maybe, if you haven't seen it at all, it may be difficult to imagine, but just to visualize such a process. Or just to see that when a person has passed away, that there is no more life in the body, actually, and that the elements go back to the elements. That is another way of contemplating. So what the author of this question says, that it seems to require more mental chatter than mindfulness or tranquility meditation. Yes, indeed, it is another type when you are doing those contemplations or visualizations, then it is a different technique than just being mindful or just concentrating on one static or rather static object. Now even our metta bhavana is also a kind of chatter in the mind, if you like. It's not just uncontrolled chattering, but it is rather guided chattering, or let's say willful formulation of a certain wish, you know, like may I be free from anger and fear. You could think that that very wish and those words that come to your mind may sometimes conjure up the anger and fear if you just say those words. Even though you say, may I be free from, like, for instance, green, try not to think of it. You've already had the word green in your mind. So it's like a kind of, maybe, wishful thinking and a kind of suppression of those states of mind and trying to replace them by something more skillful, in a way. But somehow or other, it seems to work. at least in most cases, people do feel that they are getting more peaceful and happy themselves, and also are able to wish others that same good quality. So if it works, then you can accept it. If it doesn't work, you don't have to accept it. That is one of Buddha's advice also. You know, there is a famous, what you call, sermon or discourse by the Buddha to the Kalamas, the Kalama Sutta. The Kalamas were people living around Delhi those days. And he said, don't accept anything just because it is believed by the majority of the people, or just because it is written in the scriptures, or even because I say so, but try to verify it for yourself by looking at it critically and testing it out for yourself. And if you find that this makes you peaceful and happy and it is good for yourself and for others, then you can accept it as something true. So even his own authority, he did not try to impose it upon others just on blind belief. It's a kind of, well, you could say, a free thinker's movement, Buddhism. So let me see. You know, the contemplation on death is not supposed to be a morbid kind of activity. There are certain formulations where they say death is definite, life is unsure. And we do not really know when nor how we are going to die. But the fact that one dies is 100% sure, I would say. No good money back, so to speak. But that is a fact. And of course, death has been, I think, especially in Western countries, including the United States and Europe in general, a kind of a taboo. It's not something that one talks about, really, or would think about, or even to look at a dead body. I remember when my friend's grandmother died, my mother said, oh, you don't have to look at it. It's just like somebody is sleeping, but you don't need to come. But in Sri Lanka and in Thailand, Burma, people generally come with their small kids and they actually look at... It's also a sign of saying goodbye and respect and accepting the fact that a person is no more there. Or that that person is now dead, and to see what it is, in a way, that young people get familiarized already when they're very young with that fact, and it's not sort of put into the or shoved under the carpet as a kind of taboo. So it's a bit different, and it may seem like a strange subject to talk about for some, or painful for others also, but still, maybe realistically speaking, we could talk about it a little more. But the general point, I think, in this question is that what he says, it seems to require more mental chatter than mindfulness or tranquility meditation, is also an important point, that what actually is meditation, you know, is it just mindfulness? Is it concentration, or is it contemplation on a theme or something like that? So in these cases, it is all three probably of those possibilities. When you are contemplating in words and sometimes along an existing formula, like these words of the Buddha that were put in Pali, and then you start repeating them, hopefully with the meaning of them, like, you know, life is uncertain and death is certain, there is also a kind of contemplation that the monks do at the time of just before a cremation or a burial, the monks are invited to the house where the body is kept before they take it to the crematorium. And the monks chant Anicca vata sankhara upadavaya dhammino upajetva nirujanti te sang vupa samo sukho. And that is repeated twice, it's chanted three times. And it means Anicca vata sankhara, that all conditioned things, sankhara means conditioned things, are impermanent. Just to remind one about this fact, and upadavaya dhammino, that which has come up will go down. That is the law. Upajitva nirujanti, what has arisen will fall. Tesang vupasamo sukho, that would be to get out of this constant ups and downs and this constant becoming, that is the highest happiness. So it is an allusion to the striving for nirvana instead of this birth, death, and rebirth. So that is also a kind of contemplation, but it is a kind of formalized contemplation. It's not really your own text, but the text which came from the time apparently already of the Buddha, these verses. So they sort of sum up a kind of contemplation. And it sometimes helps people to reconcile themselves with the fact that somebody is not there anymore. Their mind gets more peaceful when accepting rather than rejecting and wishing that it was different. And so in a lot of places in Buddhist countries, but also in Hindu culture, you find that there's not much crying and sobbing and moaning at burials or cremation ceremonies. If you're familiar with Bali, the Hindu island of Bali, then people do not cry at a cremation. They feel that that is a kind of, an attachment, a sign of attachment, and even maybe a kind of magnetic force to the person's soul, and not to let them go and find their freedom in another lifetime. So they want to avoid that, and also they are so familiar with it, I suppose, that you don't find people crying at cremations. So the thing about the chatter is, it's like what you would call mental activity also, rather than chatter, but based on a certain theme, can be beneficial, like with what I mentioned, metta bhavana. You know, the contemplation on death is one of the four araka bhavanas, that is called the protective meditations. And metta bhavana is one of them. So to contemplate on metta is part of a series of four contemplations which are considered to be guarding yourself or protecting yourself. So metta would be, guarding yourself against anger and hatred, for instance, by developing the opposite. And then there is a typically Buddhist kind of contemplation which is also considered to be a protection, that is to contemplate on the qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And there are certain verses for that, where the qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, you know, the highest good for the Buddhists, what they call the triple gem, are being contemplated in a traditional way. Iti piso bhagava arahang samma sambuddho vidya charana sampanno sugato loka vidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarati satta deva manussanang buddho bhagavati. There you get the nine qualities of the Buddha. So it may sound like abacadabra when you don't know the Pali language. But, but you know, even Well, yes, it's better to know the meaning of this when you are really wanting to contemplate about the qualities of the Buddha. There are translations, and you can look at the translation, sort of try to find out which word is what. But even then, the Pali language and also the Sanskrit language, they have apparently some beneficial effect, even if you don't know a word of Pali or Sanskrit. Just by the very fact that they have a lot of open vowels, like a, e, e, o, u, and also they have what is called aspirated consonants, like k, d, p, b. I don't know whether you can feel it at that distance, but you know, this is like pushing the air. It's called an aspirated consonant. And they did some experimentation in St. Petersburg, of all places, by chanting Pali texts and suttas to people who did not understand the word of Pali and see the effect on their mood. And apparently they became quiet by listening to Pali texts. So it is not meant to be a sort of a magic formula just to keep you quiet or something like that. But it also has some meaning, and therefore, you know, when you do a contemplation, like contemplation on the Buddha's, Dhamma and Sangha's qualities, then it is maybe a good idea to look at the meaning of those words as well. Sometimes they sound better, I find, in Pali, but then if it has no meaning, then it's just that maybe beneficial effect of the sound quality itself. It sort of massages your chakras, they say, this aspirated and consonants and these vowels. Then you have what is, you know, these four contemplations which are considered to be protection kind of meditation. So this one is Buddha Dhamma Sanghanusati, they call it, the thinking about or the contemplating of the qualities of Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Then Metta Bhavana. Then there's one, contemplation on the impurities of the body. Now, you know, the body is beautiful, only skin deep, we would say. When you look into the body, it's not very beautiful. And the beauty also is sort of impermanent. And people spend billions of dollars around the world per year on cosmetics to look a little bit less wrinkly, you know, and more beautiful than they really are. So that kind of covers up the truth of the matter. But contemplation on the repulsiveness of the body is one contemplation which they say is a kind of protection. Protection may be for yourself, not to get lustful about one's own or other people's body. So lust is, in Western culture, I think, quite emphasized as a good quality, but in the Buddhist meditation it is considered to be a hindrance in finding real peace of mind. So if these lustful thoughts come, then the antidote would be to contemplate on the repulsive nature of the body. Just think of the various parts of the body, which, you know, it starts with the hair of the head, if you have any, and then other kinds of parts of the body, the skin, the teeth, the nails. For instance, people say, oh, you've got beautiful hair, you know, Sun Silk shampoo advertisement, and then beautiful hair. And then, but if you find even one hair in your soup, how would you like it? That would be a contemplation on repulsiveness, you know, of hair. So, when you go to the dentist and they pull a tooth and it's just out there, it's not beautiful teeth anymore, it's just a tooth. So like that, to contemplate on the real nature of those parts of the body sometimes is a counteracting force to getting enamored by it. But of course, with tranquility meditation, you don't get into jhanas just on these kind of contemplations. And to complete, the fourth one is the contemplation on death, by the way, which we are talking about as one of the four Araka bhavanas. So that doesn't give you the kind of concentration and absorption or tranquility that just, you know, watching a neutral object, what they call a skillful object, for getting into tranquility is different from these kind of contemplations. These are more or less preparations for the meditation, you could say, these four kind of contemplations. I hope I have dealt with the subject enough, or more than enough, maybe. Let's see. One by one, and we do have a whole hour, so it doesn't really matter. During meditation, I'm always fighting to keep my mind focused, but sometimes my mind suddenly clears and I have a great meditation. Why does this happen? How can I do this more often? That, of course, everybody would like to happen. But the fact is that it's not always like that. But still, let's try to think about this one. One is the fighting to keep the mind focused. So the fact is that the mind is not focused, and then you're trying to make it focused, and then fighting it, fighting the fact and trying to make it different. Now, I don't know whether that really leads to more tranquility or focus when you are fighting the distractions. I would say probably a better way would be to become aware of distraction, for instance, to know that your mind is distracted or restless, for instance. That is a kind of contemplation on the mind which we haven't really dealt with yet as the four contemplations or four foundations of mindfulness, but this is one of them. I'm still trying to sort of come over my kind of colds that I had just a few days ago. So the fighting, I think, is not the right way of dealing with distraction and restlessness. I would say try to become aware of the fact that your mind is distracted or restless. If you just name it, for instance, restlessness, you look at it, then sometimes the restlessness is already half gone. But if you say, oh, I'm restless, I shouldn't be restless, why am I restless, can't I be quiet, then of course you're adding what is called fuel onto a fire. And it doesn't sort of peter out or cool down, it becomes worse in a way. So that becomes then a real conflict, a type of dukkha or suffering itself. So acknowledging, maybe naming it, and not getting upset about it, I think would be one of the ways of overcoming that problem. And sometimes, you know, if your mind is going off to the past, future, or fantasy, what I usually call that way, and you realize it, it's not that you should blame yourself for that, but just acknowledge the fact and try to come to something which is really here in the present. Now, the fact is also, the present is also, that your mind has gone off to daydreaming, for instance. So if you realize that you're daydreaming, you come out of that daydream back to the reality here and now. It's a little bit like when you are dreaming in the night, and suppose you have a nightmare and you wake up sweating and fearful, and suddenly you realize, oh, I was only dreaming, then that dream is gone and you're back into the simple reality of here and now. So similarly, more, let's say, less dramatic, I suppose, is when you are daydreaming and you realize it, and then you come back to the simple present moment. And for that, There are several techniques, and that is also relating to this. You know, suddenly my mind clears. That sort of happens, in this case, spontaneously. But sometimes you can make it happen by realizing, I'm daydreaming, or I have been daydreaming. Come back to either a touching point of the body on the floor, which is always there when you're sitting, unless you're levitating, of course, you know, but I don't think we've come to that stage. And it's not supposed to happen also, it just might happen suddenly. But no, you have these touching points on the floor, so that is always there. You can always refer to them to come back into the present moment. It may not be a pleasant moment sometimes, but at least it's in the present. But a more pleasant one would be, especially if you're in a quiet environment like this, to open your ears to the subtle sounds around you. There may be a bird chirping or something like that, or even the silence that you can almost hear here. So the hearing is always in the here and now, with a little pun intended. So that is like bringing your mind back into the simple present moment. And then the wish to make this happen more often, that of course is a devout wish that maybe many people have, like, oh, this is great, my meditation is better like this, but then I would say you are starting to expect that to happen, and that in itself might become a hindrance in the very happening of it, if you keep on sitting and expecting that state to happen all the time. Or you could call it a kind of an attachment to that pleasant being awake kind of state. So, but still, these little hints of opening your ears, you can do that more often, for instance, when you notice that your mind is having this tendency to flee from the present into the past, the real past, memories or fantasy or so-called future. Future is not really here, it's only in hopes and fears and thoughts about it, daydreaming, so to speak. So the main thing is, yeah, when you are daydreaming, then you cannot be really here fully mindful, because that daydream takes you away, like another kind of dream, into another reality. So the reality may be that you're daydreaming. If you realize that, that's also being in the here and now. But then to go along with those thoughts of the daydream, the contents of it, takes you away maybe from just being here. So if opening your ears to the silence around you could be something. And if you live in a noisy environment, maybe you can use the Bose earphones, the sound reduction earphones, or put on some environmental music or sounds of a waterfall or birds singing, and, you know, soft kind of silent New Age type of music or environmental sounds that are pleasant to the ear, but not that you're listening to it all the time. But if you want something, instead of hearing the noise of the neighbors or the airport or whatever, the road that's nearby, then you could put on some soft meditative type of music. Although that's not very orthodox Vipassana advice, but in certain cases, I would say that may be a good idea. So, hopefully that also is enough for this question then. If not, the author can come back in a little while. Then, can we have a brief review of the five hindrances? And also, is there a specific method to stop thinking about food? You all have that problem, it seems. How good the food was yesterday and things like that, or just not having enough in the evening, maybe thinking about food. That sometimes is a typical problem in retreats when Yeah. You're just used to just open the fridge and take out anything and everything and just cook up something at any time, whenever you want, no? But here it's more restricted, so maybe you're lacking something and there's not much to do. So food is a very basic sort of need. Sex, food, and other kind of needs. So here we're talking about food. Stop thinking about food. Well, let's make first take the first part of the question, a brief overview or a review of the five hindrances. So this is somebody who knows about the five hindrances. I don't think I've talked about them as such, but it is just about the right time to talk about them also, and we do have enough time. So the five hindrances in the meditation are sense attachment, aversion, sleepiness, restlessness, and doubts. Those are the five major hindrances that are enumerated in the Buddhist texts on meditation. And those are the things that do come up for everybody at different times, in different order. Some do, some don't, but in different degrees also, depending sometimes on your character. There are different kinds of characters, according to the Buddha, you know. To overcome things in the meditation, a meditation teacher who is called a Kammatthana Acharya, the one who prescribes the kind of Kammatthana, that is a kind of meditation technique, to a person who needs that, is supposed to have a sort of insight into the different kinds of characters. You know, some people are, for instance, greedy characters, or hateful characters, lustful characters, intellectual characters, or something slow characters. That's about what I remember, different kind of characters, or jealous kind of characters. So they may need actually different kind of antidotes for their particular problem. So let me see about this food problem, what one could think. A short kind of contemplation on what happens to the food after you put it into your mouth might do. It's not that attractive anymore. As soon as you've put it into your mouth, nobody would actually sort of give it to anybody else or even eat it again, you know. So that's a short, sort of effective, a bit of a rough contemplation, but it might be quite effective. Ooh, yeah. And the different kinds of hindrances also have their overcoming side, you know. It's not just, oh, there's a hindrance, but then how to overcome it. Sometimes the very acknowledgement of the hindrance itself can be half the solution already. If you don't realize there's a hindrance, then you're stuck in it. For instance, the what is called the getting attached to something pleasant, sense attachment, what we call. Then in that case, if it's like a lustful thought, what we already said, then you can contemplate on the what is called the repulsiveness of the body or the repulsive aspects of the body. Some is maybe beautiful, some is ugly, but in general, to counteract the attachment to the beauty, the contemplation on the repulsiveness can help to overcome that one. And similarly with food also, it's one of those attachments maybe that we have. And of course, if you don't have enough to eat and if you're hungry, then probably your mind will go to food. But if you are what is called gluttonous also, you know, always want to eat, then also your mind maybe go to the food all the time. So maybe because you don't have much else to do here, you know, like when you are busy in daily life, a lot of those subconscious desires may be suppressed and you don't notice them at all. But they may be there, but you just don't, you know, notice them. So here, a lot of things that are in the subconscious mind may be coming to the conscious level because you have nothing else to do but watch yourself, including those thoughts and those wishes or whatever. So basically it is said that by contemplating on the opposite, you can overcome that particular hindrance. So if it is, for instance, anger that comes up, anger or hatred, that might happen if one remembers something that happened to you. For instance, somebody scolded you or did something to you. Or sometimes an anger or aversion against an unpleasant feeling, a painful feeling in your body, sometimes also can make you angry. You want to get rid of it. That's the basic reaction. But then how to get rid of it? And if it's there, then it starts to annoy you sometimes. So there you can sometimes contemplate the, well, like the non-self nature. This is just feeling, feeling, feeling. And also it's temporary. It is not there forever. And to acknowledge that there is such a thing as an unpleasant feeling. So you see it for what it is. It's not like, ooh, I want to get rid of it, kind of attitude, but unpleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling. And then sometimes, as we said before, become one with it, acknowledge it, sort of embrace it, even though it is an unpleasant feeling. You don't add the hatred or the aversion towards it that makes it from a pain in the knee to a pain in the neck or a headache. So then you can avoid that mental pain from that physical sensation. And with, let's say, restlessness, as I said before, it doesn't help if you are restless that you become more restless by denying it or wishing it to be over. You know, sometimes restlessness may come towards the end of a meditation, like, oh, when is the gong going to go, and something like that, you know. Isn't it yet time, or whatever. That kind of thought may lead to restlessness also. Another restlessness might come from if you are making too much effort, wrong effort. Try to reach the goal too quickly. And that is counterproductive. That also leads to restlessness. A kind of frustration that you don't get there. So easy does it, they say. Or develop some patience. And then suddenly maybe the whole thing clears. The aversion may be gone. The restlessness may be gone. When you just take a little step back and get into the present moment. Then there's no conflict between what is and what you want to have. Some people want to practice patience. And they say, I want to be patient, but I want to have it now. That also doesn't work. Yeah. So, with the other thing, the doubts, you know, there may be doubts sometimes, and some of you may have it, like, oh, was this really the right time for me to come to a meditation retreat, or the right place, or the right teacher, or the right method? Or is the goal worthwhile, and am I doing it right? Those kind of doubts may come into your mind from time to time. And if you acknowledge the doubts, then at least there's no doubt about the doubt. So that is one way of acknowledging it. And then maybe give it the benefit of the doubt, so to speak, also to give it a try and see what happens, rather than just sitting and doubting. So these are some tips, in a way, for overcoming those hindrances. And they are just part and parcel, actually, those hindrances of the practice of meditation. Everybody encounters them at one point or another. And if you then recognize them and you acknowledge them, that's half the solution. And then if you use a little antidote, that could do the rest. Sometimes also just letting go of that particular thing, not to get too much involved in it, acknowledging it and letting go of it, if that's possible. But if it keeps on nagging and calling your attention, maybe you have to do something about it. So what is the purpose of Buddha being reborn into the human realm? Just to teach the Four Noble Truths? Uh-huh. Well, we should say it was not the Buddha who is being reborn into the human realm, but it was his predecessor, the Bodhisattva, who became the Buddha, who was born into this world and then became the Buddha. According to the Theravada Buddhist teachings, Buddhas are not reborn in any level of existence. So maybe it's just a formulation, matter of words, semantic little question here. What you mean probably, what is the purpose of a Buddha being born or somebody becoming a Buddha in this human realm? Just to teach the Four Noble Truths. Well, as if that's not enough. It has had rather tremendous implications, I suppose, in the world. But, of course, he taught it in many different ways. They say 84,000 different kinds of dharma skandhas or ways of teaching he had by meeting so many different kinds of people and formulating these Four Noble Truths and similarly, you know, dukkha and the way out of dukkha to many, many people. So they say, you know, that may be an interesting aspect of it, that consciousness of species around the world is connected. Even the rats around the world have a common consciousness, the rat consciousness. And if you know of the works of Rupert Sheldrake, for instance, anybody knows about Rupert Sheldrake? Okay, he's a British biologist who lived in India for quite some time, and he's a good friend of Jay Krishnamurti's, he was, and he's also a famous biologist. He has done experiments with groups of rats to teach them a certain trick, how to learn a particular trick, and he measured how long it takes the first group, and then he would repeat the experiment in another country, and then what came out, that the second group of rats always learns faster than the first group. You know, you do it this way or you do it that way, the second group always became faster in learning that same trick. So he was wondering, what is that? And he came up with a theory which is called the morphogenetic field theory. And what is morphogenetic field theory? That is that if something happens here, it influences the whole of that consciousness of that particular species. That's also true for human consciousness around the world. Now, for instance, if you have done an invention and you go for a patent, you might find that Mr. Li in Beijing has just asked for the patent on the same thing, you know, because sometimes these inventions happen to be interconnected also through a common kind of, field of consciousness. So if one person gets enlightened in India, then it also has a rippling effect through the consciousness of all human beings around the world through this morphogenetic resonance, what they call also another word. So if that were already the effect of it, then I think after the Buddha, if you just think about these Four Noble Truths and the fact that he has brought them out, the fact that there are people who have studied them or heard about them and were able to overcome their own suffering and reach enlightenment, there were tens of thousands of people who got uplifted, and some of them reached final enlightenment, others partly enlightenment, you know, different stages of enlightenment, or at least a reduction of their fear and their anger and their greed and their hatred. Wars were sometimes prevented by it. So I think that it's quite good enough reason for a Buddha to come into the world. Maybe enough for this one. I would say if there's still more at the door, you can see if there's more time. We have another 15 minutes. Now, in walking meditation, should the focus be on the breath, the feet contacting the floor, or both? I've heard, read, that the breath should be synchronized with the steps. Now this is a little complicated question because there are different ideas going around on this topic, different approaches by different teachers. So what I learned in Sri Lanka from the mindfulness of walking meditation was to become aware of actually the different parts of the movement of your feet by feeling your feet, becoming aware of the impulse to lift the first foot, then the lifting forward placing of the foot, then the touch sensation, maybe the shifting of the weight from one foot to the other. You know, when you lift one foot, the whole weight comes onto the other. And then to become more and more aware of details of those movements and the sensations. So the focus is actually on with your mindfulness, not with your eyes looking at your feet, but with your mindfulness, focusing it on the sensations and the movements of the feet. And that can be done. Again, you know, different teachers have different approaches, but there are, especially in the Thai tradition, some teachers who say you just start with a very general movement. Right goes thus, left goes thus, right goes thus. Or just right, left. Not like marching, you know, but slow walking. And that goes thus, meaning that you actually become aware of how it goes in general. And then you could say the lifting and the placing as a two parts of that movement. Then the lifting, the forward movement, the placing, the touching. Then the next step would be to feel that the heel is coming up first, then the lifting, then the forward, then the lowering and the touching. So you can build up that awareness of the movements and the feeling of those movements and the sensations finer and finer into five or six parts. More and more detail of that movement is being observed. Some people then become so slow in their movement of walking that, especially if it's done in a kind of a circle with a lot of people and there's not much room in between, that becomes sometimes irritating to the person behind such a slow mover, but they may be very much into, you know, all the details of their movements, very much absorbed in it. Whether we should synchronize the breath or even be aware of the breath during the walking meditation, there are some teachers who have said so, but I think the majority of mindfulness meditation teachers, well, if we think of Thich Nhat Hanh, I think he has actually mentioned about synchronizing the breath and the walking, but not everywhere. And generally speaking, the Vipassana teachers, I think, who do have walking meditation as part of the practice, that is not Goenka, because there's no walking meditation in the Goenka Vipassana courses. The walking is only to the bathroom and to the dining hall and to your bedroom, and that's about it. But no special kind of technique on walking meditation. But those who do teach walking meditation, I think they don't really ask to synchronize the breath with the movements of your feet, nor that you observe your breathing while you are walking. Because probably you cannot be fully aware of two things at the same time. That is one thing. It comes one by one. And if you look at your mind as a series of mind moments, and each mind moment has like 17 trillion moments of consciousness, then if you divide your attention between the touch sensation of the feet and the movement and the breath, then it is already divided into two or three, so it becomes less powerful concentration on one. So, on the other hand, you're supposed to also know the context in which you're walking. Like when you're walking, you should not step on insects, you know, you should not fall over little obstacles. So there is also an awareness of the other things where you are walking. So it is what is called mindfulness and clear comprehension together. It's not only one-pointedness and concentration only. It, the fact of walking itself is already multiple kind of objects, one after the other. The movement is not like one solid thing, or where you have the breath touching in one point, that is more one-pointed than the walking meditation. And just a funny thing is, for instance, persons who are, you know, practicing walking meditation in public, I would say, is maybe not such a good thing, because people might think you're a little bit weird or something like that. And also when you come to, let's say, 42nd Street in New York and you have to catch a train and you can see the man already, you know, with the whistle, and you're walking, and labeling your experience of lifting forward, let's see, and seeing, then the train might be gone before you know it. So it is a question of applied kind of mindfulness and also clear comprehension and do the right thing at the right time. But in formal sort of walking meditation as an exercise, it's, I think, better to focus just on the feet and their movements and their sensations and let the breath be natural. I remember when I said to the meditation teacher way back in 1975, when I started sort of practicing Vipassana meditation in Sri Lanka, that I felt a little bit constrained by this, you know, slow walking and so on. It was like there was a pressure on my chest. And he said, no, just be like the wind. So, you know, you can be slow, but it should not be contrived. Is that the word? Oh. Well, that's about all I could say about the questions, response to the questions. Do you still have one or two more spontaneous questions? If there are, I could try. Mm-hmm. Only on the in-breath when it's cool?
Yeah.
No, I think you could be more flexible and focus on both. They come not at the same time, no? It's different time, like when you're breathing in, it's cool. When you're breathing out, it is warm. So you don't have to sort of pick that particular characteristic and just focus on the cool breath. In that case, you would be focusing only on the in-breath and forget about the out-breath. So I suppose just it's a different aspect that you happen to become aware of. It's not just the touch sensation, but sometimes also the fact that it's cool or warm. But that is more, I think, not something that you do choose consciously to focus on that. You focus on the breath, and then you notice that it is sometimes cool, sometimes warm. Comes as a side effect or a side result. I think like that. Yes, please. Yeah, the morphogenetic resonance.
Yes. Does that happen only for good things like enlightenment, or also is the resonance happening also for those that have negative elements? And if that's the case, they're probably the majority. So how do us and monastics protect themselves from that? And also, it has to do with proximity or
The proximity of the source of those good or bad thoughts, you mean?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, probably it has more effect when you can feel it more when it is very nearby, like an angry person walking into the room or something like that. You can feel it directly. But the psychosphere, you know, you have the atmosphere around the world, but also the psychosphere, that is with the all filled with the sum total of human beings' thoughts and emotions, I suppose. So if that gets polluted by a lot of anger and greed, then, you know, the whole atmosphere, the whole feeling probably becomes more negative. And I think that has that question of how to protect yourself against it. Well, on the other hand, also what can we do about it? You know, maybe to change the vibrations to more positive things. I suppose that if more and more people would be practicing metta bhavana and loving kindness, that could counteract, you know, it's a massive force of negativity in the world mostly. And the few people who are practicing this may be a small minority, but if more and more people can do it, then it creates what is called a critical mass, that it has some effect on the environment. So that could be felt more in the vicinity probably of that group, but you know, if you look at these experiments of the rats in one place and a completely different place, thousands of miles away, apparently there is some kind of subconscious connection with all these thoughts and vibrations. So you can't get away from it, sort of, in a way, but you can protect yourself not by being swayed along by it. You know, you can maybe counteract it in yourself and not to have to go along with it if there is some kind of aggression and things like that. I have thought, you know, it's a funny thought, but I'll just utter it anyway. If one could synthesize the vibrations of metta and then send up rockets and satellites which beam metta around the world, that would be wonderful, you know, to counteract the aggression in the world. Then we would have, you know, the metta from all the time. But that may not be lawful, you know, it would be subliminal and maybe against people's wishes or something.